Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Montgomery County has struggled with all kinds of issues, from testing to vaccine distribution and a lot of pushback from small businesses to reopen. Well, tonight, we're talking about where the county is now in the COVID fight, and we're also going to discuss other issues. My guest is Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich. Lines are open. Give us a call if you have a comment or question for Montgomery County Executive Elrich at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. County Executive, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. I hope you're doing well.
Yeah, I'm managing.
Yes, indeed. That's what county executives do. They manage. So let's talk about the management of this latest a bit of news coming out of the county. A $500,000 expenditure for a global pandemic center. What is a global pandemic center? What's the plan for that?
I mean, the plan is to put together academia, the private sector, and government and create the kind of space that will lead in investigations in viruses, potential, like the SARS virus, is potential for viruses to mutate and become the next pandemic. And, you know, some of this stuff was underway going back to Obama, and then, of course, it was derailed by a certain president. And, you know, we were obviously, the whole world was caught unprepared for this. We didn't have supplies. We didn't know anything about the disease. And it took like a Herculean effort to turn things around. And I think there's a strong feeling that we should continue down the path that existed pre-Trump and strengthen it and build the center where we put together the resources that would be necessary to do the research, identify potential diseases, identify potential cures, and be ready to do what we need to commercialize and produce either vaccines or cures for things the next time a pandemic starts. So that, you know, we're vaccinating now, you know, almost a year after the thing began to unroll itself. That's a lot of, you know, death and a lot of misery and a lot of closed businesses because we were not in the position we should be. So the hope is we can put this together. There's a logic to doing this in Montgomery County because of the strength of our biotech center, which is one of the largest, most successful in the country. And that and having NIST and NIH and Walter Reed Medical, we have enormous resources in a very tight location.
How would this not duplicate what is already being done by NIH, for example?
What's being done isn't nearly enough and not nearly as focused as it needs to be. We need something. And, you know, and this is coming about from a coalition, mind you, of scientists, you know, doctors, companies, from professionals in the field who feel we need a focused, singularly focused entity that is looking at the world of viruses and looking at potential for a pandemic. But we don't have that now. We had, you know, some beginnings of it under Obama. It never reached the breadth that it should reach. And this is an effort to try to give us the capacity that we don't have. Hmm. Obviously, that stuff didn't service very well.
Well, I mean, what do you mean?
So, you know, the discovery on, for example, Novavax's vaccine didn't come out of any of the institutions that we have. It was Novavax's scientists looking at the RNA and identifying on the RNA something that coded for a pump on a SARS virus. And they were able to identify that because their previous research and work on other SARS viruses, and that led them to targeting it for their vaccine. But it didn't come from NIH, and it didn't come out of these other centers or other efforts or out of Fort Detrick. This was folks here who in the private sector had done work on SARS. So this is very hit and miss. It's not a coordinated, centralized, let's put the resources in, make sure that we're purposely looking for things. It's sort of like if you had a product and you were curious and you were lucky enough to say, hey, this is SARS. Maybe it's like the last SARS virus I looked at. You know, it happened that we were lucky enough that that's what they worked on last time. Mm. So I think the effort is to try to create something that's singularly focused on this.
I want to talk to you about the reopening process. The county has moved into a this new kind of three-phase reopening plan. Yeah. Where are we right now with that? And when I say where are we, simply how is it going? What are the metrics telling you about this reopening program? Is it mirroring what we're seeing in the region, or are you still concerned about a change, a negative change in the metrics?
I think, you know, our view is that by, you know, continuing to control the opening pace to match now the pace of getting vaccinated is going to help us continue to maintain relatively low rates of COVID in our community. You know, if you look at the state map, which they put out, you know, on a daily basis, Montgomery County, largest county in the state, now tracks at the lowest levels in the state for cases per 100,000 and for test positivity. When the governor did his last reopening, we were low, but we were clustered with other counties that were, I'd say, you know, reasonably close to us. I mean, being low didn't mean we were remarkably different. After they reopened, places like Baltimore County and Baltimore City got as high as 45 cases per 100,000. Montgomery County got up to about 12, and then it went back down again. So right now we're at 6. I took the New York Times tracker. I put in the set, I think, 75 largest jurisdictions in the country. Montgomery County is about number 13 of these large jurisdictions in terms of lowest cases per 100,000. But we were the only one at 6 cases per 100,000 today and yesterday, east of the Mississippi River. You don't get there by just going along with the program, which has not been as effective in other counties and other places around the country. So I feel pretty good about the decisions we've made. You know, I've listened to Dr. Gales and listened to what I hear coming out of the CDC and being careful to read between the political lines when it was contaminated by the former president. But I support what our, you know, health officers have recommended, and they have led Montgomery County, I think, to be one of the safer places. Still not safe enough. So in terms of reopening, we set a metric, because now that we know what the supply of vaccines is likely to be, we're no longer just looking at the case rates and the cases per 100,000. We're looking at percentage of the population vaccinated. So today we're at about in the mid-30s, maybe low 40s on percentage of people totally vaccinated. We're in the mid-50s on people who have had percentage of the whole population that's had one dose. We made the decision that at 50% of the population having one dose, we would be 50% open. When we get to 60% of the population having one dose, which we anticipate could be achieved in the next 2 to 3 weeks, depends how fast you folks out there get vaccinated, then we would move to 75% opening. And then when we get to 50% of everybody totally vaccinated, we would go ahead with even further reopening. That's our timeline.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking with Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich about all things Montgomery County, talking about some pandemic, some COVID issues. We have some other issues to cover as well, but if you have a comment or a question for the county executive, certainly give us a call again at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Some people have described that vaccination percentage as an incentive for county residents. If you want to open, then get vaccinated. But
yep.
what are you doing about vaccine hesitancy? You know, Prince George's announced just yesterday that they are doing this targeting some of the more our critical communities with door-to-door targeting, you know, staffers going door-to-door, knocking on doors, putting knob cards on, trying to encourage county residents. What is your plan to do the same? And do you believe that there is a big issue with vaccine hesitancy in Montgomery County?
Well, I don't know how big it is ultimately, but we saw a 19% drop this week from last week, and it's about 25% less than the previous 5 weeks. So I don't know if it's hesitancy. I don't know if people got worn out from that long period of time when people tried to register and there were no vaccines or not enough vaccines to register for, but we are continuing to pivot our outreach. We've, you know, had people on the ground. We've done a lot of work with communities. We made decisions early on in both the African-American and Latino community to make a special effort in outreach there because, you know, we were aware of, you know, pretty serious differences in who was getting vaccinated in the county. And they're, you know, exactly what you would expect the differences to be. We've got a long way to close those rates. So, the ethnic groups more closely resemble each other than they did before. We still have a little ways to go, but, you know, we've been making this effort to put the message out there deep into the community. So you'll be seeing new advertising. We're going to be doing stuff focused on young people because there's what we can see from the data is they are getting their rate of vaccination is less than other cohorts of the population. I don't know whether it's because they think they're immortal. I don't know if it's because people talk too much about, oh, yeah, if you're young, you don't actually get sick, which isn't really true, and you may not die, but a lot of people are suffering long-term health effects. So we're trying to take into account of all that and then target our messaging to reach out to people. We're not going to be satisfied until this is done. And I think a big part of our message is going to be just what you said, that if you're ready to go back, get vaccinated. The faster you get vaccinated, we will go back. It's not like before when, you know, and I had this endure a couple of months of telling people, no matter how many people the governor says are eligible, I can't vaccinate you faster than the number of doses I have. We're finally at a point where we could project that with the doses we have, we could reach 60% within a couple of weeks. We could reach 70% vaccination within probably 5 or 6 weeks. So we know where we could go if people walk through the door and say, I want to get the shot. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to push on.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking to Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich about some COVID issues as well as other issues in the county. Let's go to Jay calling from Germantown. Jay, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm so thank you to receive my call.
Sure.
I'm so very, very disappointed about the county and state system because it was a robbery in 7-Eleven in 2020 in February 12th. A guy robbed a 7-Eleven. I can get killed because I didn't watch a video when police came. I recovered everything a guy steal from that 7-Eleven and return it back. And police take me to hospital because I was so very, very intensely. And I received a call, and they're supposed to make a payment for my hospital bill. And until today, the bill never be paid. They didn't pay that bill, but I'm still very, very in pain.
So let me, Jay, be clear. So there was a robbery at a 7-Eleven where you were injured?
Yeah, when I was a customer. I'm a customer.
Okay.
And then I come to buy something, and then I find out it was a robbery.
Okay.
And then I engage, I don't know that time, I engage a really, really fight with that robber, and then I recover everything he stole from that 7-Eleven.
I see. So you engage the bandit, and you were hurt during that.
Yeah.
Let me see what the county executive has to say about that, because we actually are going to be talking about some public safety issues later in this conversation. Mr. County Executive, anything you want to share with Jay?
I can say that's the first I've ever heard of this. It certainly never reached my level, and I don't know I can't honestly tell you what the county policy is. If there's a crime, does the county pay for it? Does the county rely on people's insurance to pay for it? If you don't have insurance, does the county back you up? I mean, if you write my office, which is mark.elrich, E-L-R-I-C-H, at montgomerycountymd.gov, you write my office, then I can take that we can take that information and try to follow up for you.
Did you get that, Jay?
Yes, sir. I get that, and then I was very, very happy because I'm still in pain. I stay home for 2 months. I had to call a manafu for help. I call even. I talk to them, and they help me to pay my rent.
Well, see, we'll give the county executive, write him an email, and we'll see how that works out. As a matter of fact, the producer wants to chat with you briefly, so I'm going to let her take that phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Minister Fleming calling from Bowie. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm calling in reference to the churches opening up. Do you have a target date as to when they're going to open?
We're not doing anything by dates. We're doing everything now by whether we achieve 60% of the population with one vaccine and 70%, and then 50% of the total vaccine. You know, I've been totally resistant to dates. Anybody who's followed me over these last 15 months or 14 months, I refuse to give a date because I don't know what the conditions are going to be on any given date. I don't know whether we will have achieved enough people vaccinated. We didn't know in the summer whether we were going to bring the case counts down to a level where we didn't have to worry as much about community transmission. But we think we're on a path, you know, right where we are now is 50% occupancy indoors. And if we get to 60% or when we get to 60%, we'll go to 75% occupancy. All of this should happen in a matter of weeks. But I can't tell you whether it's going to be 2 weeks or 4 weeks.
All right.
But if I were guessing, I'd say it's in that range.
Minister Fleming, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich about a number of things. Don't forget, you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. If you're on the phone, stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2. And 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. This is the Inside Segment. We continue our conversation with Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich. We've been discussing COVID concerns, and we have other issues to cover as well in the county. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let me go to Edward. Edward calling from Montgomery County. Thanks for calling, Edward. What's on your mind?
How you doing? I was just calling in because I wanted to get some information on, you know, some assistance with some of these loans, the forgivable loans and assistance with rent. You know, I work 7 days a week, and it's just getting harder through this COVID as far as trying to get things taken care of. And just wanted to know if there was, you know, there's certain people that are getting access to these things, and the ones that are working real hard and really need it, we're not getting any access to any of the help.
Actually, I mean, the people who are getting access to the help are people who are working really hard and really need it. Those are the people who are eligible. They're the folks with the back rent unpaid. And I could, you know, recommend a couple of avenues. One is you could contact Renters Alliance in Montgomery County, which is a tenant organizing group. But you could also contact my Department of Housing or Health and Human Services to get information on how to fill out the applications. We are covering, you know, $1,000 a month in back rent for people. If you got your assistance in the summer, you could get assistance for the month since the summer when you didn't get assistance. So we're trying to put this money out as quickly as possible. We have about $59 million, and we've got more coming. So the money's there. Come and get it.
Okay, so you said Renters Alliance, and who else?
The other one would be to contact our Department of Health and Human Services. And I'm trying to think if I could give you and whose name I would give you. I don't have my little book handy with me. I'll tell you what, if you write my office, they'll redirect it. They just say you're interested in rental assistance. And if you write me, it's Mark, M-A-R-C, dot Elrich, E-L-R-I-C-H, at Montgomery County, M-D, dot G-O-V, gov. Montgomery County, M-D, dot gov.
Okay.
And just say you need to be hooked up with the rental. You need to be hooked up with people doing rental assistance, and they will forward your email. Be sure you put contact information in there.
Sir, I just wanted to make sure I got the email right. Mark Elrich, E-L-R-I-C-H. Did you say an M at the end of that?
Yeah, it's M-A-R-C dot Elrich. M-A-R-C dot E-L-R-I-C-H at Montgomery County, M-D. Dot gov.
Gotcha.
All right.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Edward, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Piggybacking on what Edward just shared with us, as you have obviously heard today, a federal judge has overturned the CDC's moratorium on rental evictions. And the Department of Justice says that they will appeal that decision. But what are your thoughts about that kind of ruling, since we are still in the middle of the pandemic? Unemployment is still a problem, particularly for frontline, service workers, I should say.
Yeah.
Your thoughts about that federal court decision?
As I read the story, it appeared to be one of Donald Trump's appointees. So my first reaction is the long-lasting legacy of a person who didn't care, who managed to get elected U.S. president. Fortunately, in the state of Maryland, we're not reliant on the CDC order. The governor's had a protective order out there. It lasts as long as we're in a state of emergency, which we still are. So, people still have some time, and I know the federal government has said they're going to fight it, which they should. I think the order is outrageous. The idea that we would just throw, thousands and thousands of people in Montgomery County, it could be tens of thousands of people, to the wolves and just say, I'm going to go ahead and evict you, without any understanding of the fact that people didn't have jobs, weren't earning money, is just tragic. And, we know the economy will recover at some point, and people will go back to work, and they will pay rent. And throwing people out is not going to solve the problem of your back rent. And you may not be able to find tenants who can pay the rent going forward any easier than the person who's in your building right now. I mean, you're going to have a lot of people on the street looking for housing who right now aren't employed. That's going to be hard.
The other issue pertaining to COVID-related issues is, and I remember this very clearly, you had a very spirited confrontation with business owners, particularly in Bethesda, during this pandemic about opening and reopening and what have you. Have you been able to patch up that relationship? Is that still a tenuous relationship, considering the fact that the opening process still is a day-by-day, week-by-week kind of situation?
Look, I think it's always a mixed bag. I mean, I've got restaurant owners to tell me they're really glad what I did, and that, you know, their employees, you know, because we kind of remember it was only a couple of weeks ago when the restaurant workers weren't getting vaccines. They still aren't, actually. We have never targeted the frontline workers. Side restaurant owners are worried about their workers and concerned. We've, you know, tried to be clear that, you know, if we can control cases, we will open. A lot of the restaurant owners, you know, would like to be open, but they'll also acknowledge that people are not coming inside. You know, I've been to restaurants. I mean, I'm not a hermit, and I do go out. And, you know, what I've seen is no problem getting a seat and not a lot of people dining inside. More people still opting to dine outside than dine inside when there's an opportunity. So, you know, there's different opinions on this, but my job was to make people safe. My job was to minimize, in my mind anyway, the death toll and, you know, the casualties from COVID. And we made decisions that did just that. And I'll stand on what we accomplished. I'll stand what we did against any place else and probably most places in America. And I think we did it right. I was determined, you know, when I first saw those pictures in New York City and the hauling bodies out of apartment buildings, I was like determined that was never going to happen here. And we made sure that it didn't happen here. And most of the time when I talk to county residents, they're actually happy that we protected them. And there are a lot of businesses, you know, that did survive. It was really retail and restaurants that got totally hammered by this. Because for restaurants, when I close you, I close you. And that was really costly. And nobody, even if I said you could eat outside, nobody had a comparable number of seats outside to offset the seats they lost on the inside. I'm not unaware of that. I've been an advocate for federal and state money to go to the restaurant industry to help make them whole. I'm a big believer the government should give money to the private sector, the businesses that got damaged, particularly the small businesses, because, you know, this is our country. And when, you know, after World War II, we had no problems going over and rebuilding Europe. And I'm like, getting hit by COVID was kind of like being hit by, you know, a major natural, you know, calamity. And I think the government should step in and help make people whole. It's not their fault. I never blamed businesses for the situation. And I really feel that they should have been given the help they need to recover. Mm. And the sooner we do that, the sooner they open up and people come back to work. And so, you know, and I wrote the governor a letter back in April asking them to focus on, you know, what happens after COVID, what do we do with the businesses? Because if they're not able to reopen, we're going to prolong the misery of COVID by months. And this is where it's critical. If businesses got support and could reopen, then hiring will begin, you know, very, very soon. If businesses don't know whether they're going to be able to pay rent when the governor declares everything is open, they may not ever open. And that means people may never get employed again there. So we have an imperative, I think, to provide this kind of assistance.
I want to move to the issue of public safety, police reform. And even before we drill down into that, I really want to hear your thoughts about this disturbing video of police officers and a 5-year-old child. Police officers taunting, yelling this 5-year-old child, this child who had, I believe, destroyed a laptop. The mother was called in. It's a really complex story. It happened, you know, quite some time ago, but as is often the case when video comes out, you know, concerns are revived and even enhanced because now we can see it, we can hear it. What are your thoughts about that? And we do know that the mother is suing the county.
Yep. So since you know that I've got to be limited in what I can say because we're in the midst of a lawsuit. But, you know, I did not think it appropriate to yell. I cannot believe that everybody in that room just stood there and did nothing. Nobody suggested, like, there's a calmer approach to take with a child. I do think that given the fact that the kid has left school, if I was going to call on a number one resource, the people with the most eyes on the street would have been the police. So I don't think it was wrong to call the police, but that's not what you should expect from an interaction with the police. And this gets into, you know, bigger issues about reform. There are people who are so upset with what policing has become and the image of policing that some people don't even want to see it. And there are other people, and I get emails from both sides. I've been getting a flood of emails asking me not to cut police services on two districts in the county who feel like they need police. My view is I have to fix the interaction. There's no reason why an interaction with a police officer has to be unpleasant. There's no reason it has to be tinged with racism, it has to be tinged with fear, or any of this other crap. I mean, if you're giving somebody a ticket, you should be able to go up and say, this is what you did, I'm writing you a ticket, here's your ticket, have a nice day. If you're doing a repair order, you should be able to go up to the car and say, I'm giving you a repair order because your tail light's out, show me your license, thank you very much, here's your repair order, have a nice day. Nobody should be doing the kind of stuff where they're saying, can I search your car, can I get into your trunk? And so we've actually written a directive that will stop those kinds of questions and that kind of behavior when people do stops. But this is an example of how something where that could have been a good thing, police find child, you know, and help them come back to school, turns into a bad thing. Police find child and yell at them. And, you know, that it should have been done differently in my mind.
The SRO thing, obviously a big issue, the elimination of them in county, you know, high schools and the like. Is that something you support?
Yeah, I mean, when I was on the council, I used to argue that I'd rather be putting money into social workers than putting them into SROs. I always felt that, you know, the biggest issue in schools is mental health. That is the biggest day-to-day issue in schools. We have more suicides than we've had school shootings. We have more kids, you know, who go into depression and have nervous breakdowns than we have school shootings. So I've always felt that we need more mental health supports in the schools, the school system. And, you know, in our county, and we're probably not much of an exception, has far fewer counselors and social workers than the ratios, you know, than the ratios that are considered acceptable. So we've been short on that. So I wanted to make sure we put more resources in. And we have an obligation under the state to provide coverage for the schools, and that can't be the usual call the police if you have a problem. So we've got a program where the SROs are out of schools. They're not going to be patrolling in schools. That's not going to be their job now, but we're going to have police that are in the community close enough to respond to calls from schools. I expect that means there'll be a different way that principals have to handle some discipline. And at the same time, we're working with the school system, which is actually kind of landmark for us. We got together and said, you know, instead of just, I was going to write, an amendment to the budget to send over enough money to pay for a certain number of positions. There are other council members who are going to do the same thing. After talking to the school system, I kind of realized it's a good intent, but I can't just park counselors or social workers in a school and tell them what to do because these are schools. So we actually sat down with the school system and said, let's work this out. Let's figure out what kind of supports we need to give the kids. We will work with you on funding it to make sure we're able to do it. And so we're going to work together. We're going to be on a fast track so we can deal with this issue before school start comes back in the fall. At least, you know, make some preliminary decisions. But I feel good about the direction we're going in. I know some people think that, you know, I hear things like, oh, the police are going to be in elementary schools now. It's like, no, they are not. This is seriously, they are not going to be patrolling schools.
So you, correct me if I'm wrong, you're supposed to have some kind of report on this mental health school safety partnership coming out next month, correct?
Yep.
So, and you said you just can't park social workers and mental health professionals in the school, but certainly if you had your druthers, what would that look like? And this is why I ask that, because this is just truly hypothetical, and we've seen these kinds of issues involving issues outside of the school, in the community,
right,
where... And some have suggested that in addition to police officers, when they are called, that there needs to be some kind of mental health person also on the call or immediately available in large cities, not dozens, but several dozens, some kind of hybrid social worker police kind of employee who is immediately available when you have these situations on the street. Certainly, with all due respect, as you said, to the school system and allowing the school system to manage itself. But if you had your druthers, what would you want that to look like? What would you suggest?
So you know, what I was suggesting, you know, the value of the SRO is here's this person who was untethered to a classroom, untethered to an office, who was, you know, free to be around the school and talk to students and develop relationships. In my better world, that becomes a person who's either a trained social worker or a school psychologist who is not tied to an office. I've talked, you know, for example, to the union about their, you know, the workers they've got in schools who are, you know, they have schedules. They see students all day long. They're not the free roaming person who's walking around the school, gets to know kids and gets to talk to them. So I would like to be able to replicate some of that effect, some friendly adult in the school who is, you know, there if you want to confide in them and talk to them. When I said I can't park them there is, you know, it's ultimately a school, and whatever they do in the school has got to be part of the school program. It makes no sense for me to say I'm putting a social worker standing in your hall every day if you don't want it or if you don't see how you're going to integrate it into everybody else in the school. And so what we want to talk about is what would an actual program look like? Where would these people be? How many of these people do we need? Do we need to retrain our school security? Because I think everybody forgets we actually have multiple school security members in a school. Why does this half this stuff even wind up with the police dealing with it instead of school security and the principal dealing with it? So we're going to work with the school system to come up with something that enhances it, whether I need a floating team or if there's a serious problem. Maybe you need more than one person to be able to get over to that school. Maybe you need several people to come and talk to students in the school. But that's what we're going to talk out over the next month and a half. Mm. And I'm, like I said, I'm encouraged that we're having this discussion about children's mental health. And that is real progress. And I think, you know, the school system and I both felt really good about doing this as a partnership. It's so much, you know, I was a former teacher. So much it would affect the child's ability to learn in the classroom was affected by their lives at home and the lives in the community. And so, like, you can't solve, you know, all of the achievement issues that are raised in school without dealing with the underlying problems of poverty and, you know, not knowing, you know, not being able to pay rent and the kind of instability that comes from financial insecurity. So I've been a big proponent of looking at this as two things that are intertwined. The healthier community produces healthier students. And we both have a role to play in achieving that. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about outside of the schools and police reform. Obviously, yeah. You know, several council members, Will Jawando, obviously, among them, taking a leadership role in dealing with policing in, you know, black and brown communities. This has been a really rough time, not just the past year, but my goodness, the past several weeks nationally, where we have seen just really unpleasant, difficult interaction with police. Knock on wood, nothing from Montgomery County this week. But, and I say that partially tongue in cheek, because who knows, it could happen,
right.
You know, as you know. And so from your perspective, moving forward 2021, what does police reform look like, to you? Are we, we can't have, you know, the unarmed British bobbies, one would say, but how do we, can you make policing in the county more holistic?
Well, that's what we're trying to work toward. The first thing I'll say is it amazes me that it was George Floyd and not any one of the other murders that occur every year in this country that set this off. It's not like George Floyd's death was a sudden landmark event, you know, the pivotal point in history, because black people get killed all the time in this country with it, you know, with their backs turned, with no weapons in their hands. This is not, you know, something that is a rare occurrence. It happens all too often. And so I'm just a little bit, you know, that to me is not the pivotal event. I will say that I had money in my budget. When Marcus became the chief, his first task was to start collecting data. And so they're in the midst of a more robust data collection so we could identify who gets stopped, where do they get stopped, why do they get stopped, what happens when they get stopped. And we had money in our budget for being in a consulting firm. This is before George Floyd. So it wasn't like I pivoted when this event happened. We were like, okay, we're on track. We're going to go through with what we planned on doing. So last summer, we created a group to look at policing in Montgomery County. It was a large group of citizens. It did have people from county departments, including the police. But I set it up so that all the votes on policy were made by citizens. So there weren't my staff or government staff, so to speak, weighing the votes. I wanted to make sure that I was getting the opinion of what citizens thought on this. So they've made a series of recommendations. One of the big things is moving the police out of a whole bunch of areas where they really shouldn't be. And they're not there because they're doing a bad thing. They're there because all this job has been dumped on them. You think about it. The homeless problem, we've totally dumped homelessness on the police. Drug addiction, drug abuse, totally dumped on the police. Petty crime. All these things become police issues, and they should be often social issues. So we interviewed the CAHOOTS people from Oregon last fall. We finally got an agreement with them. They're helping us create training. We're going to be implementing a CAHOOTS-like model, which will provide rapid response teams. I put money in my budget for six teams this year that when a call comes in, they will be sent to certain calls when there's any indication this could involve a mental health case. It requires training because when the call takers, for example, there was a case where the police officer in the midst of pursuing Robert White, which was a long, unfortunate incident, is talking to the dispatcher and he says, I think I might have a suicide by cop.
Yeah.
That should have been like a red light that says, back off, we'll send out a team out there. But the dispatcher didn't do that. There was no team that got sent there and they never would have gotten there in time. There was another gentleman, I think it was Fernand Berhe. I think it was a minute and 29 seconds between the police officer getting out of the car and Berhe getting shot. The dispatcher doesn't report to the officer the comment that he made to the residents of the apartment whose window I think he either broke or rapped on, or he made some comment implying that his time was done. Those kind of things would make a difference in what kind of response you send. So we need to make sure that our call takers can listen and diagnose and ask the right questions to determine what exactly are we dealing with. We need police to have better tools in terms of de-escalation. We need the ability to get these mental health teams out there. Before this happened, we had one mental health team in the county. So the odds of that team getting anywhere in the county on the edges of the county is slim and none. So these are all examples of things that we're going to do. We're going to put money in the budget so we have more rapid response, and we will hopefully go beyond six teams and increase that the following year. And we're really looking at training. We had this group that came in and analyzed our training program. They sat through the training academy and saw what was done in the training academy, and they had many recommendations for us about what needs to change, and I intend to implement those regulations. I think, that police officers do what they're trained to do. And so if every time you feel like you're in a life and death situation and you're told to shoot center mass, this is what happens. And they need a better tool. They need a better tool than a taser. So we're looking at a pepper ball that shoots 60 feet away and has the ability of enveloping a person in a cloud of tear gas. I'm old enough to have experienced tear gas. You may well have experienced tear gas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't function so well when you've been tear gassed. We're looking at evaluating that as a tool that could replace a taser, because a taser's got two shots. They don't always stick. If you're moving and running, it's even harder to stick sometimes. Whereas this thing, if it hits your coat, hits your body, it explodes and lets out, you know, the tear gas. So we're looking for different tools that would give police a different set of options. So we're looking at this holistically. But, you know, my goal is to, with training and with better tools and with taking some of these cases away from the police, not because they're bad people, but because they've been given a job that really shouldn't be their job. So we got to give that job to the people that job really belongs to. I think we can actually begin to reform policing. I really believe that we can make these changes. You know, I've met a lot of young officers coming into the department. You know, you see people who really want to do public service. I think, you know, we've got to be better trainers of them and better equippers of them. And we also need to raise our standards. I was happy that a lot of the stuff got passed in Annapolis that got passed.
Yeah, that reform, the overturn of the veto.
Yeah, I mean, the county banned chokeholds last year. We put limits on no-knock warrants, and I added some additional limits, a little beyond what the council did. I negotiated with the union last spring the duty to intervene, that you can't stand by and watch people do things. You have to intervene. And it was not difficult to negotiate with the union over that. So I see, you know, a better future for this. And we just have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, indeed. And also you got to find the money for those additional people and programs. Yeah.
But see, this is where this is one of those moments where if this is what you want, if you want better and appropriate policing, you got to pay for it. You can't pretend like this is a no-cost solution.
Yeah.
But the payoff in terms of rebuilding trust in the community and not having, you know, young African-American people afraid every time they encounter a police officer would lead to very different dynamics in the long term. It would make living here or anywhere a lot more pleasant experience. And I feel we're obligated to do that.
All right. Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich, thank you so much for spending some time with us, sir, in the middle of this pandemic that we are still in. Be safe.
You too.
Thank you, sir. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, May 5th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.